This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
So welcome to Law Talk, live edition. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Delighted to have you with us here, and we're going to be with you for the next hour. We're here for you. This is your interactive legal toolbox, and what we do is we dispense advice, information, try to help you figure out exactly how you deal with that thorny legal issue that's popped up, or if you've got a legal question, a legal comment, a legal observation that you want to make, delighted to hear from you. Our number is 860-522-WTIC. That is 860-522-9842. Between calls, let me tell you what we do. Once again, we have some carefully curated cases selected from the court system here in Connecticut, state and federal. These are all real cases. They're not made up, and they're selected because there are some points that they make, which we think our listeners may benefit from, that they may find interesting, and every once in a while there may be a little bit of touch of entertainment also. But we're going to be happy to hear from you, and in the meantime, here is the rundown. Our first little vignette, Smoking at Home, the tale of Lisa and the public housing authority in Milford where she lived. What's that about? Well, you'll hear shortly. Our second little vignette today, Smoking While Employed. If you use tobacco and you pay a surcharge on the health insurance premiums that your employer provides as a result of the tobacco use, you need to know about this brand new national class action that was filed here in Connecticut. And we'll tell you more about that. It's something which will probably affect many, if not most, large employers who use these programs. After that, probably after the break at the bottom of the half hour, we're going to visit Jessica. Jessica stopped paying rent. The landlord moved to evict her. They settled the dispute on the eviction. Now she wants her security deposit back, and she wants double the amount as damages. The landlord, well, it wants its unpaid rent. So we'll visit the trial judge who dealt with this. We'll see what he did with it. And there are lessons in here for both landlords and for tenants. So stick around and you're going to hear more about that. Finally, if we have time, this is a case from Stamford, two sisters fighting over mom's estate. There are allegations of forgery. And the judge finds them credible. But let's see what the judge did with this little drama. So that is our rundown. Once again, delighted to hear your legal issue, your legal comment at 860-522-WTIC. That is 860-522-9842. Okay, first case here. This involves Lisa and the Public Housing Authority in Milford. And just a footnote here, these are real cases. Law Talk follows a practice of not using the last name of individual parties. If it's a corporation, an entity, or a government agency, then that doesn't apply. So here's the story here, okay? Lisa ends up running into the non-smoking policy that the landlord has. Now, specifically, the landlord is a public housing authority. So they operate the property in accordance with federal regulations. And there's a federal reg which says that the landlord has to require the tenants to sign a smoke-free housing policy, basically says no smoking, and it says smoking outside is limited to specific areas defined on a property-by-property basis. And it goes on to say that failure of any tenant to follow the no-smoking policy is a lease violation, subjects the resident to all lease enforcement procedures, and that includes potential termination of the lease. So this particular building that Lisa lived in has a designated smoking area that is 25 feet away from the entrance to her building. So Lisa gets gigged. On June 8th of 2022, the landlord's video surveillance system captures Lisa smoking within 25 feet of the building. 5 days later, they sent her what's called a pre-termination notice, and it's on the basis that she has smoked within 25 feet of the building despite prior warnings. Now, this pre-termination notice is key, and you'll see why shortly. Many leases require, especially these government-funded, government-supported properties, require that the tenant be given a period of time, typically 30 days, in which to, quote, cure whatever the alleged violation is. I'll give you an example, a common example. Tenant isn't putting the trash where they're supposed to put it. Maybe it's piling up in an area where it's not supposed to. You get a pre-termination notice. It gives you 30 days to cure the defect, okay? So that's the problem here. Well, they go ahead. The landlord goes to court. They start to evict Lisa. Lisa represents herself. Just never necessarily a good idea, but that's what she did. So she writes out a handwritten special defense. She says, I have lived on the premises for 13 years and have complied with all rent payments, and I am attempting to quit smoking. And she also did another special defense, but there's one that's on the pre-printed form she did not select. And that one says, I remedied the issues listed in the pre-termination notice delivered to me under Connecticut law. So the matter goes to trial in 2023, okay, early 2023, January. The property manager takes the stand. He presents a photograph showing Lisa smoking within 25 feet of the building. He presents a smoking offense charge slip that was dated 5 months earlier, and then he presents a letter advising Lisa vaping constitutes a violation of the no smoking policy. That goes back to 2020, 2 years before these alleged violations. Okay. He also testified she repeatedly violated the no smoking policy and gave an example in January 2022. He'd issued her a smoking offense charge slip. Okay. And Lisa says, in her behalf, when it came time to testify, yeah, I'd walk to the tree where we'd smoke. And yeah, sometimes I inadvertently lit a cigarette. She says she messed up by walking in front of the building. In all honesty, she says that she had attempted to quit smoking, had tried vaping as an alternative. She did not recall receiving the smoking offense charge slip. Okay. So the judge hears the evidence. He makes a decision, and we're going to tell you what Judge Spader did with all of this afterwards, why it matters, and what happened after that. But it's time for a break, and just wanted to remind you, you're listening to Law Talk on WTIC, News Talk 1080, and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. Yeah, indeed. Welcome back. Steve Miller kicking off the second half of second part of Law Talk here on a sultry Saturday afternoon that looks more like late summer than mid-autumn. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We welcome your calls, your inquiries regarding matters legal in nature. We're at 860-522-WTIC. That is 860-522-9842. I should mention also these shows get turned into podcasts. And you can catch them at WTIC.com/podcast. Typically, they're up there by about a Monday evening after the Saturday show. Jack, we're going to get to your phone call in just a minute. Just wanted to finish the plight of Lisa here in the Housing Authority in Milford. So the judge writes a decision and he says, well, they sent her the pre-termination notice that federal law required, but they did not provide any evidence that she continued smoking outside the permitted areas after the pre-termination notice. Therefore, there's no evidence by which I can find that she did not comply with the pre-termination notice and judgment for Lisa. So, a surprising outcome, but that's what happened. Now, the judge also went on to say that his judgment was without prejudice for the Housing Authority to start a new action with evidence of noncompliance with the lease following an additional pre-termination notice. Well, you would think they would do that? Nope. They decided to appeal to the appellate court, an inherently expensive process, and when that took them over a year from the time that this judgment came down until the time they decided. So what did the appellate court do with this? Glad you asked. They looked at it and they said, Judge, you're wrong. The business about the pre-termination notice was never raised by her as a defense. She never checked off that box on the pre-printed form. And by requiring the landlord to prove that she had violated the 30-day period by smoking where prohibited, you've basically shifted the burden of proving an unpleaded special defense from the party that should have had to prove it, Lisa, to the landlord. So the court reversed. End of the story. Classic remedy. And this is a little bit of a lesson on both sides. Landlords, you got to pay careful attention to those pre-termination notices. And tenants, it's probably a good idea to get some help on these fairly early on, because many of the seats of court here in Connecticut have volunteers that can help you or materials that can help you to plead some of this technical stuff. Our phone number is 860-522-WTIC, 860-522-9842. First up, Jack from Glastonbury. Hi, Jack. Thanks for calling and tell us how we can help you.
Yeah, I've got an issue. I've been working a little bit with an attorney on this because it's somewhat difficult to deal with. It's a copyright problem that I have. And I didn't realize I had this problem, but anyway, here, let me just give you a quick synopsis of what the issue is.
Sure.
My mother died back in 2013, and then we did a, you know, a family normally kind of like divvies up some of the belongings that you can't, you know, you can't really divide, at, you know,
personal property and stuff like that, mementos.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we're sitting around a table, and so everybody's picking what they want. Nobody's contesting anything. And so there's these travel logs. They're like, little diaries, okay? And they're all bundled together. And I said, well, I'm interested. I'll take that, and I'll write it up. And nobody objected to it. So a few years later, after we'd gone through it all, we converted all of that to digital text format, and it turned out to be a lot of material, okay? I thought it would just be a small little file, but it's 365 pages of material. So I thought, well, let's make this into a book, and so that's what I did. I went to Amazon and published it as a book.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, well, you know, they ask you all these questions, you know, well, you want to copyright it? And I said, yeah, I want to copyright it, so I went to the copyright website page, the government page, created an account, and went through the forms and everything. So all of that went pretty good. And then about 6 months later, I get a letter from the copyright people saying, we got a couple of questions. And it has to do with the fact that I didn't, you know, these are my mother's writings, so who owns what in the copyright. So the attorney kind of said, well, you don't own the writings. That's your mother's writings. But you, as long as you have a clear title to the written diaries, then you can still file as the, I don't know, the wording. There's a legal wording for all of this, but basically as the person that has the copyright.
Yep, the owner of the copyright.
Yeah, okay, so I did that and clarified these questions that the guy had, the copyright office, and the guy still had other questions, and it's just going back and forth. Like, he's saying, well, are you sure you're the owner? You had three siblings that were there. Did they contest it? And I sent him a note. I said, no, you know, and it's just going back and forth, so I'm just trying to figure out what I need to tell the guy at the copyright office, because I have clear, you know, do I have to submit some sort of legal document to the federal government saying that, you know, I own these papers of my mother's, or, you know, I just can't get this straightened out.
Okay, so let me give you a couple of thoughts on it, Jack. First of all, with respect to the copywriting piece of it, that's something that I know very little about, but it doesn't sound like that's what's really causing the problem here. It sounds like they're raising an issue about whether or not you somehow became the owner of this material for purposes sufficient to copyright it. So a couple of questions concerning your mom's estate. Was an actual formal estate opened?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that question. I mean, after she died, we all sat around.
Yeah. Did you go to the probate court?
No, this was not. I don't think this was probate. I mean, we had an executor. One of the brothers was an executor, and he was there, you know, so we just divvied everything up.
No, that's fine. Here's the reason I'm asking. Because you say executor, that means there was a will, and that means that it probably was submitted to a probate court. What town did your mom live in when she died, Jack?
Well, this was in, she lived in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Oh, okay. So I'll tell you what I think the common law would be, but the Utah laws may be a little bit different than what I'm familiar with. Generally speaking, those diaries, which you turned into that copyrighted material, belong to the estate. Now, unless she had a will that gave them to someone specifically, they're going to be treated as an asset that is going to be disposed of in accordance with the will in general. Like, it fits into the residue clause, all the rest, residue, and remainder. Do you know if that was given to all four of you together?
I would have to check with my brother on that.
Okay. Let's assume it was. Here's the solution, and I have to be brief because we're going to have to break in for news in a moment or two. If you can get a document from the other four, and it can be a simple one-page piece of paper saying that we hereby irrevocably waive any claim we have to mom's diary, travel diaries, and assign whatever rights that we have to Jack, our brother, and Glastonbury, that would probably solve the problem. But it's necessary to point out that these items were part of your mom's estate and that these are the natural objects of her bounty, or they were the beneficiaries under the residuary clause. And that is probably what's driving the copyright examiner's question here. So I think if you come up with that and give them that, they'll be satisfied.
Okay, so would they want that document, like in a form of a PDF or something that they could see?
Yeah, I think you need to ask them what format it should be submitted in, but it's more of a probate question. And that music in the background is telling me that I got to wrap this up. But
right,
give that a try. Written consent and assignment from the other siblings all to Jack and Glastonbury, okay?
Yep, got it.
And let us know in a future show how it turns out, Jack. Thanks
much. Thanks.
Take care now. Okay, Law Talk continues after the news. So welcome back to the second half of Law Talk on a Saturday afternoon. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and you are welcome to call us with your legal problem, your legal issue, your legal comment. Kathy in Hartford, we're going to get to you shortly. Rob in Meriden will try to get to you also, but we've got a line or two open, and we'd be delighted to hear from any and all of the rest of you at 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. In the meantime, it is the time in the program for me to let you know that if you do not have a lawyer, and you're looking for some high-quality legal advice at an extremely reasonable price, please consider the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. So this is how it works. You phone them at a moment and a number that I'm going to give you in just a moment. So get a pencil ready. They'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal issue, because you don't want to be sent to somebody that doesn't practice in the proper legal discipline to help you for your problem. If you've got a question about a contract, you don't necessarily want to get a personal injury specialist to help you with a contract issue. So what happens is they'll refer you to an attorney that practices in the proper discipline. But these aren't just regular attorneys of the sort you might find advertising on the internet or on the billboard. First of all, they've all been vetted to make sure that they practice in the right disciplines. Secondly, they're vetted to make sure they have insurance. And third, to make sure that they are free of disciplinary problems or entanglements. Okay? So what do you get and what does it cost? Glad you asked. What you get is a half-hour consult with that attorney, and you can do it in the attorney's office. You can do it over the telephone. You can do it via video with Teams or with Zoom or whatever platform you'd like. End of the half hour, no further obligations whatsoever. If, however, you're interested in further legal services, you and the attorney are free to discuss that. If the two of you agree, then you proceed together. If not, that's it. So what's all this cost? Well, here's the answer. It's a one-time only fee of $35 for that half-hour consult. The half-hour consult is a bargain at that rate compared to what these attorneys charge at their regular hourly billable rates. But better than that, if you're calling about your personal injury case, they're not going to charge you because you've been banged up. You don't have one of those, but you've got a Social Security disability claim. Same thing. No fee for you either. And finally, one last category, your workers' comp claim. Questions about that, problems that you may be having with the insurance company for the employer. Boy, that's not unusual. Same thing. No fee. Here's the number, folks. Pencils up. 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Give them a call. Mention you heard about it on Law Talk, and I think you'll find that it's a great value for very little money. Okay, let's get to the phone calls. We've got three calls waiting, and we'll hit them in order. Hi, Kathy in Hartford. You're on Law Talk, and tell us how we can help you.
See my call. I own a percentage of a family vacation home, and I would like to be bought out.
Uh-huh.
And a family member who has expressed a desire to buy me out, there's an operating agreement, so it has to be like 80% of the assessed value of the house if I buy out. And he has wanted to deduct numerous contributions he made to the house proportionately. You know, after the assessed fee comes in, he wants to deduct pretty much by $100,000 based on, well, I own about 20% of the house, so it would probably be 20% of $100,000. And there's other things that he has not told me about that he's contributed to the house. And my question is, that would add up to more than $100,000. Is that legal for him to be able to do that?
Wow, what a great question, Kathy. I've litigated these in my private practice, so I have a little bit of familiarity with it. A couple of questions for me to ask you so we can get the fuller picture here. You mentioned an operating agreement, so I'm inferring that the house is owned by a limited liability company and you own a 20% membership interest in the LLC. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
Yes.
These are variations on what used to be called vacation property trusts. And sometimes people put them into LLCs. Sometimes they put them into a trust. Generally speaking, the plan is to pass on the property to the next generation. Did this come from the previous generation, from your mom, your dad, or from some relative?
Yes,
or that? Yeah.
Yes, it did. From my dad. Yeah.
That's what typically happens here. Now, the operating agreement, you've already given us a couple of pieces of information about it, but that has to be consulted to see exactly how the buyout that you want would occur. Typically, though, these agreements are set up where the individuals bear the responsibility for the expenses and the costs based on their percentage ownership interest, but they also have certain rights to the use of the property, typically based on that also. Does that sound like what your operating agreement probably says?
You know what? I don't have the operating agreement in front of me, but
no, I understand.
I can't answer that question. Okay. Actually, I'll have to look for those aspects.
Yeah.
I know that there's rules as to only a member can be, you know, if they want to buy out their share, it has to be another family member.
Yep.
It's 80% of the assessed value. I think I said that earlier.
Yes, you did.
In terms of the individuals responsible for expenses and costs, I would really have to find that aspect.
Okay. What usually happens in these, Kathy, is it turns into a debits and credits issue. And by that, I mean that the typical operating expenses, say for a year, are calculated and apportioned out among the members in accordance with their membership interests. If there's any income, such as maybe the place was rented, that's typically the net income after the payment of the expenses is apportioned out accordingly. But to buy it out, you have to follow the rules in the operating agreement. Now, if there's a problem with somebody who's being unfair, there's a number of ways that you can deal with that. But we're talking about the inner workings of a document that I haven't even seen here. So I can't go too far, but there are ways that those can be addressed, even if the operating agreement seems to call for an outcome that may not be fair, because there's a lot of state law in Title 34 of the General Statutes about the rights of members to a limited liability company. So you're actually better off as a member of the LLC than you would be as a beneficiary of a vacation trust, which is what used to be the preferred way to do these. What I'd suggest, Kathy, is that you check with an attorney who has some familiarity with these things. It's probably somebody who's got some familiarity with the corporate part of it more so than the other part of it. And I think you'll find that that's what you're going to have to do. But there are ways to compel somebody to perform properly. The courts exist to resolve disputes if parties can't resolve them themselves through negotiation or something of that nature. So what I suggest is have an attorney go over this with you. You're going to need some help for that. And there are remedies if you run into a stone wall and the sibling is being overly demanding with respect to what he or she believes they're entitled to. Okay, but a great question, though, and I hope it works out well. Would you give us a call on a future show and let us know how it's progressing?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Bye now. Okay, our phone number is 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. We're going to have to take a break in just a little bit. And Paul in Middletown, we'll get to you on the backside of the break. Rob in Meriden, we'll try to get to you also. And we're going to have room for maybe one more. So if you're listening, thinking about, not sure I'm going to call or not, love to hear from you. But if you wait too much longer, we won't have the time to give you the attention you deserve. What are you listening to? You're listening to Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. If you're on this planet and you can get the internet, you can join us live. Back after this. Okay, bouncing back in for our last segment of Law Talk on November the 2nd. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Let's go right to the listeners. Hi, Paul in Middletown. You're on Law Talk. Thanks for holding on, and tell us what's going on.
I actually am a retired Connecticut probate judge. I had a thought on that gentleman with the copyright issue.
Tell us more, Your Honor.
Obviously, it's, well, thank you.
Have we met before? Because I hang around those courts from time to time.
Do you do much in Middlesex County?
Only with Judge Marino.
No, then we probably never cross paths.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you, Judge.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, it's quite all right. Obviously, he's going to be proceeding under Utah law, but in Connecticut, there is case precedent. I believe it's state Supreme Court case precedent that says if what this gentleman described, that is an informal distribution of property, takes place, anyone who participated is forever barred from questioning the distribution.
Well, excellent point. I see exactly why you added. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right. So in Connecticut, I think he could, if someone was refusing to play ball and sign over the rights, he could probably go to Superior Court seeking a declaratory judgment that anyone who participated in that distribution has no rights, and clear it up that way.
Yeah, it certainly.
Obviously, you'd have to have a similar statute or case precedent in Utah.
Yeah, I think that that's an excellent point, and hopefully those siblings will agree to go along with this without giving him the hard time. I'm just wondering if now that he's monetizing mom's travel journals there, if somebody sees dollar signs in the future, they might have a little different view on it. But let's hope it works out well for him.
That was exactly what I thought.
Hey, Judge, thanks very much for the comments.
My pleasure.
I hope that we can have the benefit of your views at some point in the future, because especially with some of these matters in which you have some interest or some experience, I'd love to hear some more from you.
Well, I try to listen to the show whenever I can, so I will help you out if I can.
Appreciate it very much. Goodbye now. All right, our phone number is 860-522-WTIC. That is 860-522-9842. Okay, we're going to go to one of the previously carefully curated case summaries that we told you about when we opened the show. And this is another one for smokers, okay? And this is a case involving James versus XPO Inc., which is a great big national trucking and logistics company, okay? And James worked as a senior operations supervisor. So as with most, if not all, of their full-time employees, he was covered by their health insurance plan. Now, their particular health insurance plan provides that if you are a tobacco user, you pay a $100 per month surcharge on the health insurance premium charged by the employer. I'm sure the policy reasons are that the likelihood of healthcare expenses is probably greater, et cetera, et cetera. Now, to be legal, though, all of these plans have to comply with ERISA. ERISA is a federal law called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. I think the full name is of 1973. Now, ERISA has what are called anti-discrimination provisions. Okay? You still with me so far? So if you're going to charge higher premiums to certain people than you are to others, even if they have a health condition the others don't, that's discriminatory. Now, there's what's called a safe harbor, okay? If the plan has a legitimate so-called wellness program, then it's okay, and they got to pay for this wellness program somehow. So in this case, XPO charges the $100 per month to smokers for all of the other coverage that they get also. But the typical wellness program is a tobacco cessation program, and that's what applies here. Now, there has to be some kind of a reward at the end, according to ERISA, to keep it from being discriminatory. So the reward is that you complete the wellness program, you don't pay the $100 per month for the entire plan year. So, sounds like a pretty well thought out plan and pretty balanced. Here's the allegations that are made on behalf of James. And this is a significant matter because many of these plans have popped up and there are many, many employers that are using them. Okay? What they're alleging that if James completed the wellness program, the $100 per month fee was waived going forward by XPO, the employer. But according to James's attorneys, the law says that the employer is required to refund the $100 per month surcharge for the entire plan year, not just the portion of the plan year that remains after James completes the tobacco cessation program. Okay? And they're also alleging that the materials that the employer distributed in describing the program were faulty, in that they stated the surcharge would be waived for the balance of the remaining plan year instead of for the entire plan year. So this is a national class action, and right now it's limited to present and former employees of this one particular company, XPO Inc., and I guess it has a subsidiary that spun off called GXO Logistics. But to the extent that these plans exist and are used by other employers in their health plans, the others may very well be amenable to the same type of attack. So why are we doing this? Is this because we feel sorry for smokers? No, we don't. But it's because this is a typical example of national class actions. The individual, James, in this case, may have a claim for some portion of $1,200 because he apparently received a rebate on the $100 per month for the portion of the plan year that remained after he completed the smoking cessation program. But if the plaintiffs are correct, he's entitled to the full $100 per month times the 12 months of the plan year, or $1,200. So his individual damages are the difference between $1,200 and what he actually got credited back to him or rebated to him. So this would never be sufficient funds for James to go after a company like this on such a highly technical area. Thus, we have the birth of class actions. Ever since they have been on the books, they have existed for reasons like this, where an individual may have a claim which by itself is grossly uneconomical to pursue individually. But if there are enough other people that are similarly situated, then we have a class action. So that's what we have here. And the points we wanted to make are that this is initially against XPO Inc. and GXO Logistics. But to the extent that this type of thing has caught on in other employer health plans, there's probably a lot of other people that are going to have some familiarity with it. Now, just another note on the class action part of it that we talk about. There are several things that they have to show in order to qualify for a class action, okay? And we'll touch upon them just very, very briefly, okay? First of all, there has to be what's called numerosity. Numerosity is a big fancy word for saying there's got to be enough people to justify a class action. If you have 8 or 10, it's not going to work. Although, depending on the nature of the case and where it's filed, if you start getting into, you know, the 20s or 30s, it might work. But in this case, they're expecting that there are thousands. So that's called numerosity. The next one has to do with what's called common questions of law and fact predominating. That means that there's got to be so much that is similar in each person's case that it's efficient to deal with it all at once as a class action instead of having what might be dozens or hundreds or even in some cases thousands of class action trials, okay? And there's a requirement called typicality, okay? Another big word. And what that means is that James's claims are typical of the other members of the class because they all rise from the same course of conduct by the employer in this case. And here it's the collection of an unlawful surcharge, and they're based on the same legal theories. So that's it for today. The music in the background is my cue to wrap it up, and we're going to do that by thanking everybody who called us today, because by sharing your issue and your comments with us, you're allowing us to help a lot of other people. Also thanking everybody else who's listened, even if you didn't call, because you're part of our Law Talk family and we're delighted to be here with you and for you. Finally, but certainly not least, thanks to Kevin Corza, my producer extraordinaire. If the show sounds good, Kevin gets the credit. Other than that, it's on me. Me, I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar. And as we say, see ya.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.